Well, happy 300th episode of The Feed with Amber Mack.
And Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On this special edition of the show, we talk about the future of podcasting in 2022.
Plus, one of the actors from Super Pumped joins us to talk about the rise of Uber.
Also on the show, how Facebook built a PR campaign to take down TikTok.
And Canada's ambassador to the UN joins us to talk about the war in Ukraine.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
Trending up.
Well, Amber, 300 episodes later, can I tell you what I love most about you is, professionally, you are always ahead of the curve.
Oh, boy. It's curve, but that was our original joke from Michael trying to find his words.
In general, words are not my thing, which is awkward given the career I chose. What is, when you look back at 300 episodes later, what is it that you enjoy most when covering, because you do a lot of content about technology, speak to a lot of leaders around the world. What is it most that you still enjoy about technology?
Well, I think one of the things that's good about The Feed, and anyone who's listened to us for a long time knows that we get to cover, especially off the top of the show, the latest in technology. And so because a lot of the stuff that we do in our studio is pre-taped content, we don't really aim to be that timely with that content, but we're able to really cover stories as they're breaking and as they're happening on a weekly basis. So I love just the fast-paced nature of technology. And that's the thing I think that always keeps me interested, as I suspect is the same for many people listening.
Timely and ahead of the curve. That is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Let's get to it. What are people talking about?
Okay, so we're going to dive into the story in a little more detail later on, but we do want to mention a big story that was released over the past few days, which quite frankly, I think is not getting as much attention as it should be. And this is about Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, WhatsApp, hired a political consulting firm to run a campaign aimed at turning the public basically against TikTok. So there are many pieces to the story. I've had a chance to dive into the initial report, and it is alarming to say the least.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable that one of the tactics to help defend Meta with all of the problems that they've had, and we've reported on it and talked about it so much on this show, was things like shedding light on the prominence and popularity of TikTok and then saying that they should be held accountable just like everybody else. And that's one of their defense. And then hiring a company and getting them to have a campaign aimed at spreading stories about slapping a teacher. It's a TikTok challenge and pushing that and then saying, you know, it originated from TikTok, but it actually is interesting that it actually got pushed and became viral on Facebook. So it almost did the opposite to what they had intended. But what I don't understand is how they were allowed to and that it was okay. And now this company is actually saying, hey, it's okay what we do, and we're trying to help the company.
Well, I do want to say, and this is why we need a little more time to deal with this. So we're going to devote an entire segment to this because I do think it warrants a deeper conversation because we do know that, and listen, PR firms are hired all the time to be able to kind of get public sentiment changed about something. But I think what we have here is that this one was not rooted in any sort of facts. And that becomes a real issue, especially,
you and facts.
Especially from a platform that is causing so much chaos in the world when it comes to information warfare, which we're also going to talk about later on. But Michael, let's shift gears. And like we said, we'll talk more about that other story. We wanted to talk about sophisticated means of stealing fuel from regional farms and businesses.
Yeah, so this is in Australia. So I just recently came back from Australia, and this was unbelievable. This was a report. So obviously everybody is starting to feel the impact of higher fuel prices, both personally and from a business perspective. So criminals are turning to increasingly sophisticated and very risky tactics to steal fuel from regional farms and businesses as desperation grows over the rocketing price of oil. And they're actually using things like drones and being very organized in going in and on farms to be able to get fuel and steal it. And so what people are calling on is to try and beef up their security on farms and businesses, because this isn't just a one-off thing. This is happening in multiple areas, and it's quite alarming.
It really is. I just want to source what you just said in terms of the opening. It's from ABC News, and this is ABC in Australia.
ABC Australia.
So credit to them for this story in terms of breaking down what exactly is going on. And, you know, it's just amazing to hear, you know, criminals using drones and these sophisticated tactics. They're going quite far to actually commit these crimes. And that's going to have effect on many of these businesses, farmers included, who run these farms, and just a really clear indication of the state that we're in right now as far as prices and inflation and all of that. So, Michael, we do want to end on one final story, and this is from CNN. Amazon workers at New York warehouse vote to form company's first U.S. union. This has been a controversy for a long time now. And according to CNN, this would be the first U.S. union in Amazon's 27-year history.
Yeah, this is crazy. And also, just to give perspective of people listening, you know, Amazon employs more than 1 million people in the U.S., and it is extraordinary, the company's influence on work practices. And so this is why this is so important, because of the effect it could have, not only on the company, but obviously it could set a precedent, and then we could see other companies like Amazon follow suit, or at least their employees see that they have the ability and power to have their voice heard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is, you know, depending on your opinion of unions overall. But to me, I feel like obviously for many of those workers, and we've heard stories about frustrations that they have in terms of how they've been treated, and the importance of their role as well, especially during the pandemic, where we know Amazon has become a lifeline for many households that depend on getting goods from them. And these warehouses have been incredibly busy. So we will keep an eye on this story, but definitely some big news from Amazon over the past few days.
And a good example of how one voice truly can make a difference. When we return, we talk to Canada's ambassador to the UN about information warfare.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, he is described as a man who understands the power of words, knows exactly what is at stake, and is determined for Canada to champion human rights. Canada's ambassador to the UN, Bob Rae, is joining us now to discuss Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ambassador Rae, thank you very much for joining us. I guess the best place to start is, what exactly does the role of ambassador to the UN do? And what is expected of the organization when it comes to a war like this?
Well, I'm in charge of a mission of about 35 people here in New York City. Canada has offices at the UN here in New York and also in Geneva, which is where we have a lot of the specialized agencies like the World Health Organization and United Nations High Commission for Refugees, etc. So we, the UN here in New York is basically has a calendar that runs for the whole year of meetings, gatherings, decisions of one kind and another, divided up into the Security Council, which is supposed to be dealing with security issues, and also the General Assembly, which is the body that 193 countries are represented here. So the UN was founded in 1945. It was founded at the end of the Second World War as a next best effort after the previous run with the League of Nations after the First World War, to try to bring the nations of the world together and to do everything we can to create more positive conditions for peace, for human development, and for the expression of human rights and human dignity. That's a big, highfalutin kind of job. My job really is here is to be Canada's voice as the ambassador, but I rely and work with a whole team of people. And we're engaged in both what we call public diplomacy, which is part of what I do, and private diplomacy, which means private meetings that people don't necessarily know what I do when I do that. So I do the two things together. That's what an ambassador does. It's, I speak for Canada with the permission of the Prime Minister and the Minister, and that's my job.
Ambassador Ray, we wanted to talk about something that's been in the headlines over the past few weeks, and that it includes your comments as well as comments from others, talking about the reality that this war is an attack on the global order. For people who don't understand the scope of what's happening, can you put it in perspective for us?
The basic deal in 1945, Amber, was that the countries all agreed to treat each other with respect and to respect each other's autonomy and their territorial integrity. That means that what a country's borders and boundaries are really important, because most wars start through acts of aggression between countries. Civil wars start within a country, but wars between countries can become very serious. And the reason we're talking so much about Ukraine is this is a classic example of what we call a war of aggression. The Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, said, we are launching what he called a special military operation, which means an invasion of another country, the neighboring country, Ukraine. And here we go. And that's what he did. He started it 4 weeks ago, and involved bombing, killing, what war, unfortunately, tragically, what it involves. So the reason that this is seen as such an offense is because it's like the basic rule. You don't invade another country. That's sort of like point one. And so when a superpower, when a Russia, who is a permanent member of the Security Council that has a veto over everything the Security Council does, as do the other permanent members, when it says, I'm invading, then that's an absolute no-no. And that's what President Putin did.
I guess that's the biggest problem a lot of people have around the world, is they just don't fully understand and comprehend why this was allowed to happen and how this happened at all. Because as you said, you know, they are a member of the Security Council. They have clearly done something that is in violation of being a member on that Security Council. How do you stop this? How do you stop this from happening again? And how are people supposed to feel safe that organizations like this are preventing acts of aggression to occur?
Well, the UN doesn't have its own army. The UN is not a country. The UN is a place where countries come together, and it only has the powers that countries are prepared to give it. So this is the frustrating thing. This is the real difficult part of my job, is to say, look, we've got to get enough action going here that's going to provide a real deterrent to Russia. Now, Russia is a nuclear power. Everybody has to be aware of the stakes of the game here. If somebody comes into the poker game and has a nuclear bomb in their pocket, you're dealing with a different kind of animal than if you're dealing with somebody else. So that's a practical reality we have to deal with, unfortunately, but it is. And so what have we done? Well, we brought in sanctions, unprecedented economic sanctions against Russia, cut them off from the world banking system, targeted individuals in terms of what they can do and where they can go, boycotts of all kinds with respect to trade and other issues. It's probably the largest economic sanction program introduced since 1945, and it's having a major impact on Russia. Problem is, it takes longer for sanctions to have an effect. Second big thing we're doing is providing military support to Ukraine so Ukraine can defend itself. And the third thing is we're beginning all the investigations that need to be started with respect to crimes of war and crimes against humanity. And those things are ongoing, plus helping the Ukrainians with the humanitarian situation. So there's been a massive response, global response. It's not true to say the UN hasn't done anything. Actually, the countries in the UN have done quite a lot. And the challenge we face is, what more can we do? And that's what we're discussing these days, and I suspect we'll be discussing it for several more weeks.
Ambassador Ray, one last question for you. We are clearly in a state of information warfare. We know that there are a lot of issues with misinformation and disinformation. But one of the things that you've talked about for some time is the fact that we're also seeing an enormous amount of lying coming out of Russia. And that is really a different category. As we leave you today, could you talk about what people need to know about the fact that much of the propaganda is, in fact, just that, including many lies?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've done is to simply say this to people, because I think sometimes diplomats, other people just talk around it. The Russians have a deep commitment to lying to people and saying things are not happening when they are happening and saying things are happening when they're not happening. And they do this all the time. Historically, under the communists, that was one of the hallmarks of Russian propaganda. But the thing that I find fascinating is that hallmark has not changed under Putin. Putin has said, you know, he's not a communist. He says, I did work for the KGB, but I don't work for them anymore. And you just say, I don't see the change. And I think the key thing, I mean, their foreign minister said the other day, we're not invading Ukraine. He said, yes, you are. That's exactly what you're doing. It's called invasion. He said, no, it's not invasion. He said, yes, it is. Same thing. Today, the Russians are saying, well, the people, all those bodies that they found in the little town of Bukha, those bodies are fake. That's all fake news. It's not real. And you say, yes, it is real. We have eyewitnesses. We have people who are going there physically to see it for themselves. So we know it's true. And we have to just keep fighting this. You fight propaganda and lies with the truth and with facts. And so that's what we're trying to do, is get the facts on the ground. But it is a very large part of our public diplomacy, what we call the air war, if you like, which we're now in, is getting the facts out there so that people can see that the Russians actually are lying. They're not telling the truth about what's happening in Ukraine.
Well, Ambassador Ray, I wish we had more time with you. We wanted to thank you for joining us today. We want to encourage people to follow you online, especially on Twitter. And thanks so much for your time.
At Bob Ray 48, glad to join you. Amber, Michael, nice to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, we dive into the role of women in the early days of Uber.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167, Celeb Spotlight.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Audiences are loving rise and fall stories, especially when it comes to tech moguls. In Showtime Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, we are seeing an incredible story around the birth of the global ride-sharing company, as well as the rise and fall of its founder. The cast includes Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Kyle Chandler, Uma Thurman, and Carrie Bichet, who is here, who plays Austin Gate. Carrie, thank you so much for being on The Feed with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to talk about this show. I find it a really fascinating thing to be talking about right now in the history of technology.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's fascinating as well, because we have seen a number of shows that talk about the rise and fall of tech companies, but many of those tech companies have fallen. Uber is in a different category where we're still seeing its rise in many ways and we're using it every day. So how do you prepare for a role like this?
So I read all of the articles that Mike Isaac wrote and published as they were coming out, you know, as all of this news was happening in real time. And then Mike collected it all into his excellent book, Super Pumped, the Battle for Uber. So I read the book. I did as much research as I could about the real life person that I'm playing, Austin Gate, although there's very little out there about her, which is really interesting to think I'm playing a real person who is going to watch the show. She's about my age. And there's an episode of television all about their office party that they had in Vegas, just because they happen to work at an office that's changing the world.
Carrie, was it difficult playing somebody who is real? Because the subject matter, sometimes, you know, it's quite outlandish when you read it on paper, but then to realize while you're making the show, wait a second, this actually happened.
I try to draw a distinction between the character that we created of this real life person and who she really actually is. You know, the events of the show are journalistically true, but things like the content of private conversations, we could never know. And so the writers have to extrapolate. So it's kind of a delicate balance of both invention and, trying to be true and honest to what we think the core of those people and their motivations were. And I think about Austin as, the character that we created as a person who really got on board with this company and really believed in the power of what they were doing. And then, over time became disillusioned as, the true nature of her boss that she's deeply committed to kind of became clear, and his limitations as a leader.
Now, I have to say that usually I try to stay all professional in these interviews, but as someone who hasn't had a drink in more than 20 years, I was just excited to see a young woman on the screen. And this part is true in terms of Austin and her history with alcohol. She became sober at a very young age. That did play a role in your character. Can you talk a little bit about why that piece was important in terms of who the character is?
Yeah, I'd actually love to hear from you about how you felt we did in terms of representing what that is. You've got what I imagine to be a pretty stressful, high-powered job. You were talking to me about your ability to multitask. And I can imagine, I guess, in my experience, learning about Austin and who she was and her experience, working at a place like Uber for anybody would be stressful just to the max. And so it would, I imagine, test somebody's resolve who has issues around sobriety. And I think of her as a person who this character that we invented as taking all of that passion and commitment, and she had to force it into something. And I think it was this company. And she really learned how to hustle and wrote the playbook for dropping into new cities with Uber. And it feels like she took all of that passion and commitment and put it into her new job. Amber, not to get too personal, but I wonder how you balance your stressful job with your history.
Yeah, I mean, it is, an interesting kind of role reversal in this interview process. But I will just say that I started my career in San Francisco in the late 1990s at a company that was focused all on technology. I worked in a very male-oriented environment. And a couple of years after, I actually quit drinking for good. Like I said, that was 2 decades ago. And one of the reasons was just that for me, it just wasn't sustainable to have that high pressure job and to continue to drink alcohol as well. And I guess before I throw it over to Michael for the next question, I just like seeing someone sober on screen. And we don't see that enough when it comes to characters. We always see the characters struggling, but we never see them after they've chosen sobriety. And in this case, when you think about Austin's journey, that had a huge impact on her success and the success of Uber in the early days. So I thought you guys did just an awesome job, and it was refreshing to see that.
Well, thanks so much. And congratulations. Big deal.
Well, and following on from that line of questioning, Carrie, is it difficult to find and strike that balance of showing a strong female character who doesn't play a victim, that does sometimes choose things that people may not agree with, especially now that we can look back and look at the story of Uber? Sometimes people looking in might question the decisions, but as you said, she was committed to the company, she was driven. How do you find that balance to make sure that you're showing a strong female character that sometimes does and doesn't make the right decisions?
Michael, that's a really sensitive and lovely question. And I'm also just going to take this opportunity to try and strike strong female character out of our collective vocabulary. I really endeavor to choose characters who make a lot of mistakes, I like to play characters who move the story forward, people who aren't just relational to other characters. And I also like to think about them as being women incidentally. I guess that's how I think about characters, a strong character is really just the role that they play in the events of their life and in the events around them. That's what makes them strong. And I think overcoming weakness, learning how to deal with failure, is also a really interesting character trait. I think it would be just unspeakably boring to play and watch characters who never made mistakes.
Absolutely. Well, we do want to encourage people again to watch the show. It's called Super Pumped on Showtime. I have seen every episode to date. And Carrie, once again, we love your role in the show. We love watching the show and hearing these stories. And thank you so much for taking time to join us on the feed today.
What a great chat. Thank you guys for watching. I really enjoyed my time here.
Up next, we speak to Andy Slavitt about the inside story of leadership and failures in the White House during COVID.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the Spotlight.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. As restrictions begin to ease in most parts of the world with regards to COVID-19 and things slowly start to return to normal, what have we learned? That is the question we are going to try to answer today. And we are so lucky to be joined by a former Biden White House senior advisor on COVID-19, Andy Slavitt, who is also the host of In the Bubble and is the author of Preventable, the inside story of how leadership, failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. Hi, Andy. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here with you.
I wanted to kind of start in the early days as we were reading your book. I would love to go back to March 12th of 2020. In your book, you talked about the fact that President Trump downplayed the coronavirus entirely. Can you take us back to that day and talk a little bit about maybe what could have been different?
Well, you know, at the earliest stage of a novel virus, time equals lives. So the earlier you can warn people that something's coming, the quicker they can protect themselves. There's not a lot of tools you have. But the one thing you can't do is sit on information that the pandemic is coming and raging here. And we know from a number of sources, including Bob Woodward's interview with Trump, that he was aware in January. And in fact, we have evidence in the book of conversations, which we replay, where President Trump was informed in January about the severity of COVID-19. And, you know, he then said nothing until his hand was really forced in the middle of March. In the middle of March, you may recall, that's when the NBA went out. That's when the stock market started tanking. You really didn't have much of a choice. But those 6 weeks, at any point during those 6 weeks, he could have stood up and said, hey, everybody, we should be a little bit concerned here. We should just take a little bit of warning here. And instead, when he had a scientist that, from the CDC that actually said such a thing, he reprimanded her and removed her. So that was very costly.
Andy, should we still be concerned today? Fast forward 2 years later, are we prepared? What has changed? What kinds of policies have we got in place or should we have in place, especially, you know, changes to the healthcare response in the U.S.?
Well, the biggest difference between today and the past is we have a number of tools, finally, that can help us all stay safe. We have rapid at-home tests. Of course, we have vaccines and boosters, which are recently re-recommended that people take. We have various therapies, including some oral therapies that you can now at over 2,000 sites in the U.S. If you do get diagnosed with COVID, you can go in and take cover there. And of course, we all have the ability to wear masks, even if they're not mandated. So, you know, we live in a society that over the last couple of years has given us a number of tools to protect ourselves. Now, at the same time, that's happened, of course. People who started to feel safer started to take fewer precautions. And that may be okay for them, particularly in down periods. But we have to remember that there are millions of people who are not able to keep themselves safe at this point. They're either not able to get vaccinated, they're older, they've got comorbidities or, you know, compromised. And so even in situations where there's a quote unquote relative lull, for some parts of the population, this is still quite a serious threat.
It's interesting, too, I think, in terms of what's taken place as far as a breakdown of trust. And you know, there are many things that worry me and continue to worry me. But this one piece to me feels like the most problematic going forward. When we see this erosion of institutional trust, how is that repaired?
It's a great question. And it's a great point. And I actually think it's something that precedes the pandemic by quite a bit. But, you know, there's about 20 to 25% of the population that doesn't trust government at all, doesn't trust science very much, doesn't trust scientists, doesn't trust institutions as a whole, certainly doesn't trust the FDA, the CDC, and certainly doesn't trust pharmaceutical companies. And that trust has disappeared for a variety of reasons over time, including the fact that, you know, I think people have felt that those institutions weren't working for them and weren't helping them. And until that's reestablished, you know, there is a lot that is at risk. But so this opposition to vaccines and vaccinations and so forth, I think is about a lot more than just the vaccines. I think there are people who take all kinds of other vaccines that won't get this vaccine because, you know, in their community, opposing vaccines is equivalent to opposing the kind of institutional forces that you're talking about that people feel disconnected from.
So how do we fix this? How do we move the U.S. into more of that community focus for the next time to ensure that we want to, you know, protect our community, get vaccines? What needs to change? What does government need to do? What do people need to do?
I think people need to understand the fact that, you know, we are our best defense against many things. And helping one another and looking out for one another is how we've always done it throughout the ages. And if we're not willing to do that, if we're not willing to wear a mask to spare our neighbor's grandfather from getting COVID, if we're not willing to sew a mask, if we're not willing to make some sort of supportive small sacrifices, then we're going to have a really difficult time with things as they hit, whether it's climate change or whether it's COVID-19 or another pandemic or the biodiversity crisis or the overuse of antibiotics. There's just a lot of things that you do as a member of society, we've historically tried to do, that help everybody, even if they don't help us individually, collectively. It makes sense to do. And in the U.S., we've got, you know, a sentiment that says, if you tell me what to do, you're stealing from my liberty. That's an important debate to be had. You know, we value the liberty that we have here in this country. But we have to ask ourselves whether or not making other people unsafe is the way we want to use that liberty. And the reality is that it's a debate that I know we're not alone in this, but we have a uniquely individualistic lens sometimes in this country. And I think it's important to recognize that that has costs.
We just have about a minute left. And I know this is a difficult question to answer in a minute, but I noticed on Twitter that you recently got your fourth shot. So could we just get some final words from you in terms of the importance of staying up to date with things like boosters?
Yeah, well, look, I'm 55 years old. And, you know, I think the CDC came out and said that if you're over 50, but under 65, boosters are available for you. And if you don't want to get COVID, just like you don't want to get the flu or anything else, having a booster is a smart thing to do, staying up to date as they make those recommendations. If you're over 65, if you're immunocompromised, it's even more important to do that. You know, we can prevent ourselves from getting sick. We can prevent ourselves from spreading virus if we do this. We're blessed to have great science, but we have to use the great science. Otherwise, it sits on the shelf and doesn't do us any good.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us, and wanted to share one more time that people should definitely listen to your podcast. You're the host of In the Bubble and also the author of Preventable. Thank you so much for being with us today, Andy.
A pleasure.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. As we promised off the top of the show, we're going to dive further into this story that was in the Washington Post. In fact, it was an exclusive to the Washington Post about Facebook paying a GOP firm to basically malign TikTok. So if you look at the article, it is behind a paywall. Thankfully, I was able to get a copy of it. It talks about this PR agency, Targeted Victory, how they basically reached out to local news organizations and they crafted a campaign that essentially would talk about how TikTok is a threat to American children. And
don't you find that ironic? Like, because obviously that is what people are criticizing Facebook for. And that's the part I can't get past, regardless of the rest of the story. There is fact that has, and fact after fact that's come out of how harmful Facebook is. And then they thought this was an okay form of combating that in the general public.
Well, here's the thing, is that this is Meta's approach to many things. So think about all the controversy that happened with that report about younger girls specifically on Instagram and how it could lead to self-harm, and the whistleblower from Facebook, Frances Hogan, and that whole story. What did they do almost immediately after that happened? They started talking about the metaverse. They changed their name. So this has always been my issue with Facebook or parent company Meta, is that they don't fix the problems in their own backyard. They try to divert attention. And in this age of information, I think people are more savvy and they understand what's going on. And that's the sad part to me, is that they feel they have to go out and do this instead of fixing really, really important problems that they're causing in the world in the first place.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think that you are right. And finally, we are seeing users actually show whether or not they are savvy and whether or not they will stand for it. And what I mean by that is, when the last report on their financial returns, they are losing users for the first time in, 15, 18 years since their operation or their history. So, and we did see boycotts in regards to advertising. So I don't know if it's enough, but in the midst of all of this, to then go and hire a company like Targeted Victory to focus on campaigns aimed at spreading stories like these ones, Slap a Teacher on TikTok, The Challenge, and others, it just makes no sense from a business perspective. And also it goes back to that question, like, don't you have a responsibility for the people on your platform? And you definitely shouldn't be pushing and saying about another platform.
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron, I just wanted to bring you in on this, because this is, again, a story that I don't think is getting enough attention. But does this surprise you? Is it at the level where you're sort of, you know, taken aback, or does it just seem like status quo when it comes to Meta?
It surprises me on one hand. And then when I think about maybe the age demographics of users, it kind of doesn't surprise me. You know, the part of me that's surprised thinks about things that Instagram has done. Instagram, of course, owned by Facebook / Meta, what have you, to cannibalize Snapchat usage. Instagram added stories. And then to cannibalize TikTok usage, they added Reels. And I have talked to teens and tweens, and I know I don't think Reels have done the damage to TikTok usage that Facebook thought they would, Meta, sorry. So I am kind of surprised they undertook this effort. But it's also, again, the broad generalization of Facebook.com users is older, maybe a little less in touch, maybe don't know people that use TikTok on a daily basis, and maybe more susceptible to paranoia-inducing headlines like this. We've seen things throughout the 20th century and 21st saying, XYZ is destroying the children. Well, I think maybe the Facebook user is more susceptible to that. And that's why the cannibalizing didn't work in one arm of the business. So they're attacking in the other arm of the business.
Do you know what I'll find interesting, Amber, is speaking of rise and fall stories, which we covered earlier in the show when we looked at Super Pumped. So the team behind that, their season 2 offering, I believe, is focused on and will be looking at Facebook. So that will be so interesting to see which parts of the story of Facebook they cover and just how they deal with. I mean, there is a treasure trove of really poor behavior and bad decisions in Facebook.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to watch that series as well, just to understand kind of some of the decisions that were happening at the company in the early days and even today. So, you know, it's not to take away from the fact that Facebook in particular, as does Instagram, plays an important role in our society for small businesses, for many people who are building community.
Can't somebody build something for those people that's wholesome and healthy and positive so then they don't have to deal with Facebook and Instagram?
Well, I think we might have new leaders in the tech industry who are going to potentially build platforms and technology that is better for society. But right now we have a bunch of players who, quite frankly, I don't think that is their goal, right? And that's a big issue that we're seeing is that that's not necessarily their intention. I don't think they believe they have any type of responsibility to make the world a safer and better place.
Accountability. And if people read your newsletter, they would know the importance of accountability and how it should be a focus both personally and professionally. AmberMack.com.
All right, thanks, Michael. You know, I've told you before, those are just subtle messages to my friends and family in the newsletter. But nonetheless, Aaron, I know we only have a minute or two left, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, because this is the first thing I thought about when I saw the story, is that as a content creator, I have to disclose paid partnerships on Facebook and Instagram. And yet Facebook can go out and get op-eds written in newspapers and not disclose who was behind them. So Aaron, is it like, okay, we're the big boys on the block, so we can do this, but the little guys can't?
It certainly seems that way. It certainly seems like one set of rules for one set of content creators or the company and another set of rules for the people that are putting the content on that platform. It's a little interesting and a little infuriating.
Yeah, it absolutely is infuriating. And I think, again, when it comes to op-ed pieces, I think one of the things that is frustrating is that newspapers obviously need content. This is an interesting story with a catchy headline. And at the end of the day, I think the thing that bothers me the most is just how much pressure small businesses and small creators face on Facebook in terms of disclosure. And then they go around and do this as though they can play by different rules. And Michael, just some final words from you on that.
Do what I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
That's you know, you remember hearing that saying as a kid. It's just unfortunate in this instance. It's not healthy for anybody. And I hope that accountability wins in the end of the day, or at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Anyway, this is a story that there's always these stories, you know, unfolding, but this is a big one that I think people need to pay attention to. And they may think it's a targeted victory, Michael, but I think it's a big fail.
Touche, my friend, touche. 300 episodes later, and I still love you and your humor. Up next, we discuss the rise of podcasting and a new Super Listener report.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time now for Socially Speaking. And this week we are going to talk about something I don't think we've ever talked about, which is an incredible thing. So we've had obviously 300 Socially Speaking topics. This is all about podcasting, and I thought it was interesting. I find myself listening to more podcasts, but there was a report that came out recently from Edison Research, and it dives into podcasting, advertisements on podcasting, why more people are listening, what they want from podcasts. But maybe I'll start with you, Aaron. You are the only one who works professionally in the audio space. What are you seeing in terms of people's habits with podcasts? Is there still growing demand?
I think SiriusXM also now is in the podcast sphere. In addition to programs like this, you can get some other podcasts inside the SiriusXM app. And SiriusXM has bought most of Stitcher as well, a podcast platform. So we've dipped our toe in those waters. I don't know if I see anything different in the content. I see difference in the delivery methods and the way and the platforms people use to listen to them. I started out, like I'm sure a lot of people did, that have iPhones, with the native podcast app that was built into the phone by Apple. And since then, I jump around from platform to platform, depending what Bluetooth speaker I want to connect to in my house, which smart speaker I'm listening to, which voice activated speaker responds better than the others. So I actually don't know if I have my own personal observations in differences in the content, but more in the delivery and the availability and accessing of the content.
It is interesting because I do find myself of late, or I guess post-pandemic, listening to podcasts more than anything else. I've turned off television. I don't really watch the news. And I do actually remember ads from podcasts, whereas never before would I be able to tell you what ad I saw during a program on traditional television, or if they were inserted from a digital perspective, if I was watching content on my smartphone or something like that from a video perspective. So it is interesting that this research does find that over 50% of people can remember what ads they've listened to during a podcast. And also what was interesting, and this is how I find my podcast, is from other avenues as well. So, you know, like Aaron mentioned, I found it from Instagram posts from people, and they would mention a content piece or someone that they've interviewed, and then that would make me go and find the podcast and then actually listen to the episode. But I don't give podcasts enough chance if they don't tell a good story. If they don't ask a good question, if there's not a good back and forth within 3 to 4 minutes, I give up and I turn off that episode.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I think you're right. I've never really thought about this before, but I often do listen to the advertisements on podcasts. And I remember, like, if you asked me who the advertisers were for some of the top podcasts, I could probably tell you. But if you ask me any TV show, I'd just tune out. I don't listen at all. So that's probably why they're so much more valuable. I also think it's fascinating that in terms of the super listener category, and that's what this study is all about, many people are listening to podcasts through YouTube. In fact, about more than half. So Aaron, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but is this a habit you could see, like watching full podcast recording? Ironically, we did a video version of today's podcast. So we'll put this online too.
For me, it depends. It depends on the content. It depends on the host or hosts. Depend on the guests. It depends. I listen to a lot of soccer podcasts, and specifically MLS podcasts. That's kind of my niche. And some hosts are more animated than others. And some hosts started out as comedians before they became podcasters. So they have a good presence on camera, and some not so much. So I don't know, but also it's some podcasts, I'm sorry to say, and like a lot of people, keep it on kind of as audio wallpaper in the background. And that's why I have it on the smart speaker while I'm cooking or while I'm prepping dinner. So I can't devote the attention to watch it on YouTube. I'll have it in the background and kind of be doing things at the same time. So it depends. But I'd say YouTube is like the minority of the platform I would go to, the least amount for finding and listening to podcasts.
I think, though, a lot of people might listen to podcasts through YouTube just because they're used to going there for video content. So I know I don't, for a podcast, I don't think video straight away. So it is odd, for me at least, to go to YouTube to listen to a podcast. So that would be the only thing. And I do like audio because it is cleaner. I don't want to have to watch something. I do like kind of going around the house or doing other things while listening to it. And I do seem to pay more attention to audio rather than video. And I think you do hone your listening skills a little bit better than video.
Yeah, I think it is. If you look at some of the big podcasts, and I don't want to kind of name names, but there are plenty of them out there, I do think that they have risen in popularity because they do video for every single.
Is that just for social, do you think, just to help with the marketing perspective?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just television.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for social. It's to build their brand. Like, video is such a powerful medium, as you know. And so I think it allows people to have sort of a visual of what's happening while the podcast is being recorded. And so I think that piece of it just, you know, lends itself to the popularity of the podcast because it allows people to kind of see in a different way and build relationships in a different way. So I feel like this is one of those trends that's going to keep growing. Although, as you know, I mean, we're
doing a lot of work, though. Video, it's like very different to podcast and audio. Don't you think it's like a whole different mindset from a presentation perspective?
But I think the podcast video recordings have actually affected television interviews because now it's kind of okay to show up on TV with a professional podcaster's mic.
Yeah, yeah.
And sitting in a kind of your little home studio. So yeah. I think that has actually changed the sort of interview process.
But we still can't wear pajamas, right?
No, that's okay. Not cool. Aaron, just out of curiosity, when you think about all the hosts that you work with, we know that we are your favorite, but are many of them kind of doing video to try to push their podcast as well?
Not as many as you might think. Like you said, it's a whole other level of production, of involvement, of editing. It requires broadening of your team. So not all of them are, and it's it's kind of interesting to see what kind of hosts pick and choose to include video. And you're right, like Michael said, it becomes television after a while. But not that many are that I work with, maybe aside from you guys who are my favorite. Don't tell anyone else.
I just love that you assume nobody else on the channel listens to our show, so they won't know what you just said.
Oh no, they're gonna know for sure. I think that's true. Okay, so let's talk for a second about relationships with podcasts, because I feel listening through audio without the video component allows you to create a more meaningful relationship as far as your relationship with the podcast itself. It's a much more intimate.
Like more intimate, really.
Yeah, it is more intimate, right? Because you're kind of in their ear.
In their head.
Aaron's rolling his eyes, even though we can't see him, because it's like, yeah, that's why radio is so popular. But Aaron, do you think that's a different relationship? Like, do you find SiriusXM listeners are pretty hardcore because they feel like they kind of know the hosts intimately?
I guess this is kind of a tangent to the main topic. I mean, I jumped to SiriusXM from terrestrial radio, from AM radio for a long time, and I found that the listener and subscriber is more engaged because they were paying for the product and not receiving it for free in the background like AM radio has been for 100 years. But when you're talking podcasts, there are a multitude of free podcasts, and then there's subscription-based podcasts, and there's bonus subscriber content. So I think it's all tied into the amount that people are shelling out. I think the people that choose to go to Patreon level and multiple Patreon levels deep feel more connected because they're paying for it, but then they get more in return. Whereas the people who only subscribe to the free level and don't get the bonus episodes and the bonus mailbag or what have you, maybe feel a little less engaged because they're less engaged.
So my question to both of you then is, do you judge podcasts based on the quality of the production and the sponsors in the show? Because I do find that I question if I hear a sponsor, should they be a sponsor with that show? Does that make sense? And then I will or won't listen to them further based on that as well.
I wouldn't say that the advertisers make a big impact. I wouldn't say the production quality makes an impact until it's bad. I mean, the idea is that you don't notice it, right? Until it's
like, oh, wait a second.
It becomes so horrendous on the ear that you just can't listen anymore. So that piece of it. Aaron, have you guys changed like is there more pressure on the quality of your recordings because the landscape has kind of opened up to more people?
I'm going to get up on my high horse and say no, because we've always held ourselves to a high quality, and there's lots of podcasts out there that aren't good quality. They're still out there and churning out episode after episode with inaudible hosts, three people around a round table, one person inaudible. So I feel that we've held ourselves to a higher standard in the first place, and we're waiting for people to catch up to us. And just to Michael's point before, I judge podcasts on whether they have a table of contents and time codes in the episode page. And if there's no time codes for me to jump ahead, I don't listen. That's my breaking point.
So my final question for you, Amber, there's so many podcasts out there. Everybody seems to have a podcast. Do you think that's necessarily a good thing?
Well,
that is a loaded question.
I certainly think that it's good that there's more people creating content. There's more opportunities for advertisements. There's no more ways to listen. There's more views or viewpoints. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing that it happens, but I would kind of agree with Aaron that people underestimate the importance of quality.
And that means content and production.
Yes. And that seems like a good time to wrap our show, because people can let us know what they think in terms of production quality, podcasts they listen to, advertisements. You can tweet us at Amber Mack and at mbancroft80. And of course, please use the hashtag The Feed.
Happy 300th episode, Amber. This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, channel 167.